What's up, Eves? Hope everybody is having a phenomenal day, phenomenal evening or morning, depending on when you're watching this. And most of all, a great week so far. Happy Friday to everybody out there. We are, of course, coming at you now with the video stream for the Daily Peel of the Day. You guys know how this goes. It is currently 9:48 p.m. right now, so we're coming at you a little bit later than usual. I just had to go pick up my dog from surgery, so he's got some brand new hips. He's ready to go. He's all fired up. He's actually contained in a cone and the most depressed that I've ever seen him. But then again, I have had him for about 6 weeks, so it's really not a whole lot of time, but, you know, thoughts and prayers go out to Gussie boy. Anyway, let's go ahead and get into some market action for the day. So, WSU Alpha Portfolio is once again killing it. I mean, I can't say that I'm surprised, but I'm definitely impressed, to say the very least. We were up about 93 basis points on the day, almost a full percent. Absolutely smoking the S&P 500, but we did still underperform versus the NASDAQ, which, you know, once again, when you're we're letting the NASDAQ kind of gain some steam on us here a little bit. The S&P is way too easy to beat. You know, we were trying to let them run up a little bit, but they only rose 74 basis points today, whereas the NASDAQ kind of danced all over us and the rest of the market with a 1.68% rise. We saw some very strong gains, particularly from Apple, NVIDIA, and Google. And we do hold shares in Apple and in a lot of the other names that rose quite a bit on the day. But, you know, obviously it's a much smaller weighting to big tech than the S&P 500 is. That barbell strategy coming in once again. But hey, we'll take beating the S&P 500 every day of the week. All right, moving into some of the more, lesser stories that we haven't talked about yet and might talk about in the future, but didn't care enough to talk about at least today. Let's get into some of the banana bits. Oh, before we do, actually, thank God that I left this in the banana bits or I would have forgot. Join our Discord server. We just launched a Discord server for all of you Daily Peel subscribers, and we got some even more exclusive channels for WSO Alpha subscribers, our very wisest apes of all. Now, everybody who joins this Discord is a very wise ape. I mean, clearly, to be hanging out with WSO, shooting the shit about markets and all losing money together, what could be more fun than that? It's like a modern-day r/Wall Street Bets, is how I would like to call it. We're bringing the energy back. We might not be, you know, sending stocks to the moon like GME, but once the WSO Alpha portfolio does become an ETF, expect similar performance to GME in January of 2021. All right, join our Discord server. It's linked in the Peel or search. I actually don't know how you would find that outside of the links in the Peel. So go fucking to the Daily Peel edition and click on that shit and join there. Go in there and tell me which one of my opinions you hate the most. I would love to hear about that. Let's get some energy going. Let me know what I've been the wrongest on, besides my grammar and word pronunciation. What have I been the wrongest on, or I guess the most wrong? Anyway, let's get into some actual stories for the day. So this is something that we're going to be talking about on Monday because it's very pertinent to you all, to myself, to everybody in WSO Academy, and really the entire U.S. economy here. You know, investment bankers, out of the goodness of their hearts, these people are willing to put in 80 to 100 hours per week just out of the goodness of their hearts in order to be driving shareholder value. And the ruthless economic gods, they took away that ability in the first quarter of this year, or at least in March, because deal activity fell about 22.8% in the month of March. So obviously, they don't want us to be out here getting our bags, or I should say you guys that actually work on M&A transactions. Let me know if that's actually slowing down a lot for you, but you know, if you didn't get the Evercore offer, this is clearly why. Anyway, the cost of not being homeless, aka monthly home payments, has now hit a fresh all-time high at $2,787. This is just another all-time high. Pretty much every month before it has set an all-time high as well. So we're not too surprised, but we're definitely depressed. And we're going to be talking about housing in just a couple of minutes. So make sure to stay tuned for that. Make sure you're aware of exactly how fucked you're going to be in terms of buying a house over the next decade and a half or so. Now, anyway, California came out and basically, you know, I don't know if you guys heard this, but Elon came out relatively recently and said that, hey, we're going to be launching a robo-taxi service in the beginning of August throughout California and throughout the United States, really. So they're getting kickstarted on that robo-taxi bullshit. Meanwhile, FSD hasn't really fully launched yet, so it seemed like Elon was jumping the gun a little bit, and California did just confirm that Elon was jumping the gun. Apparently, they have robo-taxi regulatory bodies. No idea how that's been created already, but they do have Waymo out there and probably like Mobileye and Motional and all these other bullshitty ass autonomous vehicle companies. This is the kind of thing where network effects reign supreme. So there's going to be one big winner, kind of like it's like a Pareto distribution kind of thing. You know, the big winner is going to get 80, 85, 90%, and then there's going to be some other players absolutely killing each other for that remaining 10% there. So basically, California came out and said that we have not heard from Elon and we have not heard from Tesla. They have not told us that they're going to be launching this robotaxi service. So as of right now, kind of smells like some bullshit. Elon's a big overpromiser, but he's usually an overdeliverer as well, even though he overpromises and then the delivery is even better than the overpromising. Sometimes it just takes a little bit of extra time, and if that's what it takes to get us to Mars and to get electric vehicles everywhere, and to get electric vehicles up to a quality where, you know, people can actually use them effectively, hey, we'll take it. No pun intended, but we are here for the ride. That's off the dome right there, guys. I mean, Jesus Christ, how do we do it? Anyway, wage growth. All right, so we got some private tracking of wage growth here. You guys know, you know, the government data is pretty good. They try their best to go out and collect this information, but counting is very difficult, especially when you're the U.S. government. So we very much prefer private companies tracking things, except that shitty-ass ADP payroll report. But indeed, they track wage growth, and basically, wage growth has fallen back to pre-pandemic levels. We're at 3.1%. That was the exact average that we achieved in 2019 for the entirety of the year. That's what we saw for a gain in March. Wage growth is back to normal levels. That's actually below the CPI as well, so we're officially back to normal, basically. You know, growing wages, but definitely not by enough to, you know, keep up with inflation, and that's why everybody is so poor, depressed, homeless, uneducated, overeducated, really, or whatever else it might be. So, you know, kind of a depressing report there. We'll probably be talking about that soon as well. But for now, let's go ahead and get back to the boring stuff. I mean, the super fun stuff. Back to boring just happens to be the title of this report today because inflation reports are officially back to be boring here in the United States. We got a CPI report yesterday that we actually didn't come on here and talk about. My condolences again. Dog just had surgery. There's been a lot going on around here. But we got a CPI report that basically set the world on fire yesterday. Markets sold off. It came in at 3.5%. It was much higher than expected. Then we got an actual inflation report that has some meaning beyond emotional value today in the form of the PPI. This is the producer price index, and this is where we find out wholesale prices. So wholesale prices, this is intermediate goods and final demand goods, but what they call final demand goods really is like the cost of like getting an item on a store shelf before the retail markup, effectively. That's what we're talking about here. And so this can be indicative. It's much more of a leading indicator, whereas the CPI is very reflective. It's a lagging indicator and shows you how fucked you were in the month prior. This kind of shows us how fucked we're currently getting and we're going to get for at least the next like month or so is basically what we're kind of looking at. And wholesale prices actually came in below expectations on the monthly rate, about 0.2%. So 0.2, that's kind of, it's roughly in line with what we'd want to see. Again, in order to do 2% inflation for a full year, you would need to see monthly rates of about 0.165%, I believe is that annualized number. Somebody check my math on that. But seeing 0.2%, we're definitely headed back in that direction. And when we look at the annual number, although it came in higher than expected, it was just 2.1%. Pretty damn good, if you ask me. Now, if we scroll down to the core inflation numbers, it doesn't get a whole lot better. So, as we know, core inflation has been outperforming headline inflation for quite a while. A lot of this is due to increases in, obviously, food and energy costs, because that's what they strip out of it. Now, we did see relatively strong declines in energy costs, but we did not see the same thing in food costs. And, you know, food rose about 0.8% on the day, but because of that decline in energy and the way that it gets stripped out of the core reading, that decline isn't going to impact the core reading. So that's why we saw an annual reading of 2.8% for core PPI for the year. You know, obviously not at that 2% level, but still continuing that downtrend. Not necessarily anything to get too concerned about. And that's why the market barely blinked at this report. You know, they took this in stride. They did not mind at all. And there's basically three big reasons for it. There's basically three big reasons why markets did not react to the PPI in the same very strong way that they did to the CPI report. First and foremost is just because of the headline number. Secondly is the predictive power of both reports. And thirdly is going to be goods versus services. So to kick things off, headline inflation. Now, PPI came in at about 2.1 or 2.8% on the core and headline readings, or on the headline and core readings, respectively. CPI, on the other hand, came in at 3.5% and 3.8% on the headline and the core reading side. So anytime that we're seeing a 2 in front of the number for inflation, the market psychologically is just kind of like, it's not that bad. At least, you know, it might not be great, but it's not that bad. Unless we were getting a bunch of zeros and ones as the first number of the month prior, which we haven't seen since we came off the gold standard, potentially, probably won't ever see again. But either way, that headline number, just the psychological relaxation of knowing that we're still in the direction of 2%, it's more than good enough for traders to get off its ass. Now, the predictive power, this is kind of where things get a little bit gray, because the PPI actually does have some predictive power. So The fact that it came in much hotter than that 2% of the core reading should be a little bit worrying, but I think the bigger news that the market took away from here was that we came in below expectations on the monthly side. So, like I said, headline PPI was 0.2% for the month of March, expectation were at 0.3%. So, just coming in below, markets are kind of taking that in stride and saying, all right, we came in below expectations, so inflation going forward should be below what we might have expected. That's basically the thought process there. Finally is goods versus services. You guys might not know this, but the United States is very rich. I mean, doesn't feel like anybody in it is, unless your last name is Bezos or Musk or Zuckerberg or something like that. But the United States, big economy, very rich, very big bank accounts and shit like that. And so when it comes down to the split between goods versus services, more developed economies like the United States become much more services oriented. So in any given year, our economy is going to be somewhere between about 68%, 70% driven by services, or I should say consumer spending is going to be driven that much by services. And so that's kind of what we're seeing right here. Now, the split between growth and services and goods cost is another kind of big driver for the spread. So we did see an uptick in services inflation. Now, it wasn't a major uptick or anything, basically on par with what we've been seeing over the past couple of months. But we saw a much steeper uptick in goods costs. So, you know, that kind of split, the fact that we're rising more in the segment of the economy that matters less means that this is, you know, it's not as important. Now, we're getting very pedantic with things already. If these are the questions that we're asking, we're in a good position. This is a good problem to have, all things considered. Now, effectively, what this means is that J. Powell's medicine is finally starting to work. You know, the pandemic spending that we did, that absolutely put us in this position. So although Jerome Powell's medicine might be taking us out of this disease, it is certainly what put us into this disease. It's kind of very much like trying to lose weight and eating cake and candy all day long. But then you start to take Ozempic and you actually start to lose a little bit of weight. J-Pow is basically giving the economy a dose of Ozempic. So that's kind of what we've been seeing right here. And much like the drug itself, to everybody's surprise, it's actually starting to take some weight off. So, you know, shout out to J-Pow once again. I would make out with him if I could, but, you know, unfortunately, I'm not in Washington, D.C., but otherwise we'd be all over that. Anyway, let's go ahead and get into some of the stock movements of the day. First and foremost, we have Paramount Global. I know, shocking to see this as a ripe stock, but it was up 7.3% yesterday on some weird news. Effectively, we had a CNBC analyst who came out here and said that merger talks were approaching the quote-unquote fast lane, and that the new CEO, his name's David Ellison, who's going to be put in charge, is basically saying that he's going to come in and make radical changes. There's going to be massive cost cuts, to use his exact words. Shareholders are pretty fired up about that, which is good because shareholders have been fucking pissed this entire time, especially at Sherry Redstone, because it seems like she just kind of wants to jump into the next deal that's available. They want to make sure that it's going to be accretive or at least not completely destroy their kids' college funds. So understandable resistance from the shareholder side of things. Can't really blame Sherry for just trying to get out of the company that her dad started either, but investors were clearly hyped up to see that the new CEO, he is all about business, or at least he's trying to project that personality at the very least. We'll see if it actually comes into fruition. Meanwhile, we had Apple up 4.3% on the day. Apple, I can't remember the last time we wrote about Apple and what's right, but you know, a lot of that is because everybody just shits all over Apple. Everybody always says, you know, we're a peak Apple. That's one of those very easy target companies to point out a lot of flaws within. So it's kind of more difficult to come out and be bullish on this thing, but nevertheless, Bank of America did it yesterday. So they came out here and basically reiterated their buy rating. They slapped a $225 price target on there and said that they expect another 180 basis points of gross margin expansion going forward. And the market has been pricing this in. They also did say they would expect an additional 150 basis points in terms of operating margin expansion as the company shifts more towards a service-based model. And that's all going to be occurring over the next couple of years. So I guess the present value of Apple's free cash flows then increased 4.3% on the day. That's what the market computer at least calculated. So this thing is back up. Let me go ahead and check, actually, its market cap versus that of Microsoft. So Apple's at $2.70 trillion right now. Meanwhile, Microsoft is at way fucking bigger. Oh my God, it's at $3.18 trillion. I thought they were getting back to being close, but absolutely not. Microsoft is dominating. All right, let's go ahead onto the rotten names of the day here. Very stinky stuff. And these are very boomer companies as well, so apologies in advance for that. But first of all, we have CarMax. This is a used car retailer. You probably used it if you bought a car in the past couple of years or so, or CarGurus or some bullshit like that. It's basically all the same shit. Anyway, they came out here, big swing and a miss on their earnings report. We are officially back in earnings season, by the way. today, when you guys are watching this on Friday, it is officially the earnings solstice. This is when we're starting to get a lot of the big banks reporting. But of course, CarMax and Fastenal and some other shitty companies that nobody really cares about have started to report earnings this week already. CarMax absolutely killed the vibe. Before the party even started, they destroyed the vibe. Basically, missed on sales, missed on earnings, shitty-ass guidance. Everything that could have gone bad with an earnings report went bad. Now, obviously, that's tough for the day, but it does kind of allow management to set themselves up for the future. You know, if we're bringing things down already, we're taking all the heat nice and early, maybe we can start to expand going forward. So that's a big hope. Shout out to CarMax. Good luck to you if you own those shares. Moving on down below, we have Fastenal. You know, when I looked into this company, it said that some of the biggest products that it sells include things like nuts and studs. So naturally, I assumed they were talking about Daily Feel subscribers. And I was like, how are you selling people? I'm pretty sure that got outlawed in 1865. But either way, turns out that's not what it is. It's actually one of my dad's favorite companies. And it's definitely one of your dad's favorite companies as well. Your grandfather probably has a shrine to it in his house. Because in addition to nuts and studs, they also sell bolts, screws, hinges. I'm running out of words. My dad's a carpenter. He would be so disappointed in me right now. Anyway, let's go ahead and continue with exactly what happened with Fastenal. These guys made the same mistake that CarMax did. They came out here and absolutely sucked ass on their earnings report. They missed on EPS and sales. So that's kind of the sucking ass part. But it wasn't as big of a swing and a miss as CarMax. We'll cut him a little bit of slack. Tell your dad to get into Home Depot and go buy some random shit. Gives him an excuse to get away from the family for a while. So he'll probably be all on it. It'll help out Fastenal and probably his investment portfolio as well. All right. Moving on down into the thought banana today, we have one question. Who's going to run this house tonight? Not this town. Sorry, Jay-Z and Rihanna, if that's who that song is by. But we're saying, who's going to run this house tonight? Definitely not Gen Z. All right. So the NAR, the National Association of Realtors, the guys that just got their clocks cleaned, in a lawsuit, which actually fucked over Zillow stock, which we released a report on that you should definitely go read. But they came out here and they dropped a report that breaks down what's going on in the housing market. And by what's going on, I mean which demographics are driving the market right now. Now, if you think it's anything besides Gen Z, you are absolutely correct. Great guess right there, the most obvious guess in the entire world. Generation Z currently makes up about 3% of all home buyers in the United States, and about 2% of all home sellers. I don't know who these sub-26-year-olds are that are out here owning and selling homes, but shout out to you guys. I mean, I don't know how you managed to buy property while you were reading Harry Potter, but, you know, clearly you did it, so good for you. What we did see was absolute dominance from people like the Gen Xers and the younger boomers. Now, I know younger boomer sounds like an oxymoron. Basically, they're talking about people who are boomers, but aren't... I want to be nice here. Aren't... struggling to get up the stairs. Let's just put it that way. So those guys are absolutely dominating the market. Gen Z has been completely priced out. That's really the big story of the day here. Now, this story, they also do count the generations a little bit weird. Most of the time, people will count 1996 as the start of Generation Z. They are counting it as 1998. Or I guess it would be 1999. Either way, I am personally way too close to being considered a millennial by this survey because I was born in 1999. So this is absolutely ridiculous. But this is all part and parcel with the story that the average age of homebuyers in the United States has been increasing throughout all of history. Now, this does kind of make sense just given that we're living longer anyway. So it's kind of still at the same point in your life in terms of like percentage of overall life. Like if you're only going to live to 80 years old and you buy a house at 20, that's a quarter of the way through your life. If you're going to live to 100 years old and you buy a house at 25, that's a quarter of your life as well. You're older, but it's the same percentage kind of thing. That's effectively what we're seeing within this trend. So, you know, it kind of does make sense at the same time, but home prices, like we said at the top of the conversation here today, have reached the highest of all time in terms of their overall cost. Now, if we go to certified smarty pants, Mr. Torsten Slunk, he's the chief economist over at Apollo Global. He pointed out as well that the largest percentage ever of the U.S. housing market is made up of new homes. So what does that mean? Well, first and foremost, it's a lot nicer homes because we can assume that newer homes are going to have things like central air conditioning, multiple toilets, I guess, and bathrooms potentially. Hopefully super high ceilings because who doesn't fucking love those? But either way, there's more new homes that are making up the housing mix in the United States. So that's going to bring up the overall average price. That's a big reason why this is getting pushed up. And it's a big reason why bringing down home prices is going to be difficult through increasing supply. Typically, we think of a more kind of commoditized market. you know, if you increase the supply of oil, oil is all the same. It's going to bring down prices, but not all houses are created equally. Abraham Lincoln would absolutely hate this, but not all houses are created equally. So obviously that's going to be increasing costs, despite the fact that it's also increasing supply. It's going to take a little bit longer to feed its way through the system. So kind of what we're hoping for is enough new homes come online that starts to lower that equilibrium price point, and that existing homes fall into a range that idiots like you and me that are trying to buy houses this year can't actually fall into. So, you know, fingers crossed that it actually works out. Very rarely is this the kind of thing that does work out, but we'll take the new construction. That's all moving in the right direction. My big question here, you guys know I'm the last person to say that the government should do anything. Is this the kind of thing that the government should be like sponsoring or providing some kind of a service for younger people? I really don't know. They pay for every cost related to anybody over the age of 67 in the United States. What can young people get besides paying for a grandparent's retirement? I mean, might be a little bit of a fair trade right there. I really don't know. Obviously, inheritances are going to play a big role in this over time. Probably not something for the government to get in, because everything that they seem to get in on just seems to skyrocket in price. Think healthcare, think education. So we wouldn't want that in the housing market to make it even worse, but it doesn't really seem like it can get a whole lot worse at this point. So I'm kind of willing to try everything at this point. Let me know how wrong I am on that one in the comments down below. All right, before I continue yapping about how I want to make out with J-Pow and whatever other bullshit I said here today, let's go ahead and finish it off with a quote of the day. One of my favorite investors of all time, it's not connected to anything that we wrote about, I just wanted to drop some wisdom from him, Mr. Jesse Livermore. He came out here and said, "Don't take action on a trade until the market itself confirms your opinion. Being a little late in a trade is insurance that your opinion is correct." Guys, I implore you, I'm begging you, if you consider yourself a trader or an investor, go read Reminiscences of a Stock Operator. It's by Edwin Lefebvre. I think it's how you pronounce his name in the original French, something like that. But it's basically it's like a pseudo autobiography. I can't believe I just put that string of letters together, but it's effectively a pseudo autobiography. What I mean by that is this guy, Edwin Lefebvre, is pretending to be Jesse Livermore and writing this book from Jesse Livermore's perspective. Drops a lot of wisdom in that, so it's not Livermore himself, but it's basically the exact same thing. Livermore was a trader before the SEC was even invented, before the Great Depression, like way before all that stuff. He began in the 1910s. He's actually a Massachusetts guy himself, so probably a big Red Sox fan, even more reason to love him. But he was, at one point, he was considered one of the richest men in America. Not considered, he was one of the richest men in America just through his trading alone. He, you know, made millions and millions of dollars, blew himself up, and then made millions again. He did it three full times, and after the third time, he did choose to end his own life. So, very tragic story. I can't believe there hasn't been a super popular biopic made about him, but the best we can get right now is going to be by going and reading that book. Go check it out. Whole ton of market wisdom in there. Unlike for myself here personally, obviously, if you made it this far, that is very evident. So, I'm going to shut myself up. It is currently 10:11 p.m. here. So, guys, best of luck trading tomorrow. Don't blow up your entire accounts. Happy investing, happy trading. Stay tuned. Bye now.